This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley, broadcasting from my home in Maryland. All 50 states are now at least partially reopened this week, but health experts warn this could mean thousands of new deaths if they reopen too fast. Top economic officials say a wave of small business closures is coming. Can Congress move fast enough to stop that? And two dams fail in Michigan. What does this mean for the more than 10,000 people who must relocate in the middle of a pandemic? It's the Friday News Roundup. Joining us to talk about the week's top national stories, Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Cheryl, welcome back to 1A.
Hi, Celeste. I'm joining you from my home in Maryland.
Nice. Jonathan Lemire is White House reporter for the Associated Press. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Glad to be here again.
And Rhonda Colvin is congressional reporter for the Washington Post. Rhonda, it's great to have you as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, all 50 states, as I mentioned, are now in the process of reopening after weeks, in some cases months, of lockdown. Where does that leave the economy? Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Fed Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell tried to answer that question during a virtual Senate hearing on Tuesday.
But, you know, the number one thing, of course, is people believing that it's safe to go back to work, safe to go out. And that's about having a sensible, thoughtful reopening of the country, something we all want. And something that we're in the early stages of now. That's what it will take for people to regain confidence, I think, and resume their activities. Again, at a different pace, depending on the nature of the business, the nature of the activity.
That was Fed Chair Jerome Powell. So, Rhonda, what did you take away from that hearing? What were the important points?
Well, I think both Secretary Mnuchin and also Fed Chair Powell, they both stated that, you know, we are facing very grim times. They didn't downplay that the economy is going to take a very long time to bounce back to the pre-virus levels. But their perspectives on how to start to recover were a little different. Jerome Powell tends to stay a bit neutral, and he told members of Congress in that hearing that he believes that more aid to states and local governments might start helping, whereas Mnuchin sort of mirrored the president's stance, which is reopening states is going to be the key to reopening the economy. So it wasn't surprising that both men took differing perspectives on how to reopen up, but it's certainly interesting that they both were on the same page, being very clear that the economy is not going to bounce back very quickly.
And Mnuchin said during the hearing that jobs numbers will get worse before they get better. We did see 2.4 million more people file for unemployment benefits last week. That brings the total to 39 million unemployment claims. So, Cheryl, Senate Majority Leader McConnell vowed to end the enhanced unemployment benefits in the next rescue bill if one passes. Where might that leave workers who are unemployed?
Well, I think that's the question that Democrats are asking. You know, Democrats want to extend that insurance, and we don't know how the economy can bounce back, as the president likes to say, if it even can bounce back, if so many people are unemployed and their unemployment insurance is ending. So I think workers are very worried. As you said, we now have a total of 20 million people in the United States out of work. That is an extraordinary number. And I think we're in uncharted waters here.
Yeah, we seem to say that every week. Jonathan, there is, as Rhonda alluded to, seems to be a difference of opinion, at least between Powell and Mnuchin, about how to move forward. Both of them helped to create the $2 trillion CARES Act, and now it looks as though they may have a different idea about how to move forward. Where does the plan to come up with another rescue bill and get it passed stand?
It's still in its early stages. I mean, there have been meetings on Capitol Hill. Secretary Mnuchin was over there this week to talk to the House Speaker. The president has made clear that he does want to see some sort of new package. The Senate Majority Leader McConnell has suggested, in fact, some reporting this morning suggests that he wants to keep this one under $1 trillion and wants it to not be a short-term fix, but to address long-term issues. That may not square with the timetable that comes from the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, where, of course, The president's focus is going to be this November and his reelection. That is the driving force behind his push to for these states to reopen their economies. We saw him in Michigan yesterday doing that and then taking some swipes at the Democratic governor while he was there. And there's a limit to how patient he is going to be. He knows that, you know, if a lot of states and local governments, if they don't receive some sort of federal funding, they're going to lay off a lot of workers. That's going to go on to the unemployment numbers that are, of course, his record right now. And this is a president who just a few months ago thought he was running for re-election on the backs of a robust economy. And now he's staring at historic unemployment rate and real concerns that things won't turn around in time before, from his perspective, before voters go to the ballot box this November.
And there's also questions about the action that's been taken already and how it's been implemented. There's a lot of pressure right now being put on the Small Business Administration because of its handling of loans that were available to businesses as part of that CARES Act I mentioned earlier. Rhonda, what is happening here? What is the criticism? What's the source of the criticism?
Well, there appears to be more backlog with the applications to the Small Business Administration. And, you know, I think some members of Congress have signaled that they do want to see SBA officials on the Hill, or at least virtually, in a hearing. So I think that's going to be one of the next big congressional hearings that you might see is on how the Small Business Administration has been getting through the backlog, how they've been handling all the money they've been given for these programs for small business owners. I know that members on both sides of the aisle have said they have tried to reach out to officials at the SBA and have not had any luck. So I really think that how the small businesses are going to recover is going to be a big part of how we move forward. And you're going to see maybe a little bit more congressional oversight on their handling of the loans that they have been entrusted to provide for small business owners.
Yeah, I expect an aggressive audit of who got money and when. But let's talk about large businesses as well, because some major retailers are doing well, announced some quarterly earnings this week. We saw that Target and Walmart were up by 10%. Jonathan, do we have any idea what's leading to the rise for at least Target and Walmart?
I think there are a few things at play here. Stores like that obviously are able, you know, to have more resources at hand where they're able to potentially stay open in ways that that others can't. They obviously are spread out and some, they have operations in states that were not as hard hit by the pandemic as others. Of course, they also do brisk online business. And that's what we're seeing is real, perhaps shift in the economy. And the question is whether it's a permanent one. As the people who are, have been largely confined to their home for months have gotten used to the idea of even more than before, of just going on their phone or their tablet or laptop to order whatever they need and have it delivered. And, you know, perhaps we'll be reluctant to return to the brick-and-mortar stores, you know, even as the virus eventually does fade away, whenever that might be, because of concerns of getting sick, if there are still infections, but also just ease and convenience. I think there may be some real changes to the how Americans shop, how consumers do go about doing that in the months ahead. There's a lot of reckoning we still have to, down the road, that we'll be figuring out from this.
And the other thing, Cheryl, is that some big businesses...
Why Walmart and Target are doing well. And I think it's because they are like the old-fashioned general store, right? It's one-stop shopping. They have everything from, you know, clothing to household items to grocery items to, you know, they have pharmacies. And at a time when people are reluctant to go into stores, you know, you don't have to go to, you know, the grocery store, the pharmacy, the clothing store, whatever. You can do it all in one place. And I think that's an advantage that they have in this time.
And, of course, not everyone has benefited. Kohl's saw a 44% drop in sales. Macy's is predicting a $1 billion loss in the first quarter. And Rhonda, last week, JCPenney filed for bankruptcy. Do we expect more bankruptcy filings, Rhonda? Are there dark signs ahead?
You know, you might, because you can even look to last year and the year before that. A lot of department stores were struggling then. You had hearing stories from Sears about how they needed to close. And I think this is a part of a problem that had started well before coronavirus, but is certainly playing out as people are really analyzing their needs right now. Their needs are at Walmart and Target, or Home Depot and Lowe's, who have also been doing pretty well right now. And their needs may not be at stores that are providing clothing or gifts or things that we may not be utilizing right now. And that's, you know, across the board. That's low-wage earners as well as high-wage earners. We're all assessing, you know, what do we need? And those needs seem to be at those stores that have pharmacies and home goods.
Yeah, exactly. As Cheryl was saying, this is a great question for our listeners out there. If you are doing online shopping, and I assume most people are at this point, where are the stores that you keep returning to? Where are you most frequently buying your provisions from? Let us know. You know how to reach us. You can comment on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at 1A. You can also email us 1A@WAMU.org. Still to come, we'll take more of your questions and your comments. We're speaking this week with Jonathan Lemire, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And Rhonda Colvin is congressional reporter for the Washington Post. I'm Celeste Headlee. You are listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. But that's the This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're talking about the week's top headlines with Jonathan Lemire, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Washington correspondent for the New York Times. And Rhonda Colvin is congressional reporter for the Washington Post. And of course, you're our other guest. And we love to hear from you. You can comment on our Facebook page about what's happening in the nation this week. Tweet us at 1A or email us 1A@WAMU.org. So at this point, the U.S. has more than 1.5 million confirmed cases of coronavirus. That is the highest number of infections in any nation. President Trump tried to put a positive spin on that this week.
So when we have a lot of cases, I don't look at that as a bad thing. I look at that as, in a certain respect, as being a good thing, because it means our testing is much better. So if we were testing 1 million people instead of 14 million people, we would have far fewer cases. Right? So I view it as a badge of honor.
Jonathan, how does that differ from what we're hearing from medical experts, especially in terms of our level of testing and whether we can be proud of that level?
A badge of honor is an odd way of describing this moment. I think two things can be true at once. There's no question that the testing across the nation has improved. In recent weeks. That said, it is still behind, well behind, what most public health experts believe is needed to safely reopen the country. The president, of course, doesn't want to wait. He has been pushing the reopening, suggesting the testing is not necessarily needed. He's been touting drugs that people can take now to treat symptoms or even to as a preventative, including this anti-malarial drug that he himself surprised us by saying he's been using for 2 weeks. I believe he said today is his last day for using that. And I should note, there's a new analysis out today that suggests that it leads to some real negative side effects, including heart problems. And of course, he's been touting the vaccine. He believes that they commissioned Operation Warp Speed. He has said that he believes a vaccine can be ready by year's end, but that also flies in the face of what most medical experts have said, who say even the most, Dr. Fauci, I believe, said even, and he considered himself an optimist in this, but he said even the most aggressive timetable would be 12 to 18 months.
Yeah.
The president seems to think that one could be ready by this fall. And I've talked to people close to the effort who say that, you know, even if things were to break exactly right, which is no guarantee, and a vaccine were to be available by this fall, it would be, there's no chance to manufacture it for the number of doses needed to for all of America. Perhaps, and this again would be a blessing, first responders, healthcare workers, and so on, maybe could get access to a vaccine by the end of the year. But for most Americans, it would be mid to late 2021.
Yeah, and Cheryl, it is sometimes difficult to know what the president means by some of the things that he says. Last week, he said testing was frankly overrated, and it's not clear what he meant by that. How can we connect that with possibly thinking that too much testing will raise the numbers too high and that might be bad for re-election? How do you interpret that?
Frankly, too much testing is not overrated. I mean, I interpret that as just a simply an inaccurate statement by the president. It's extremely important that we do testing. In fact, testing is really important for the states to use as a guide to how they reopen. We need to know the breadth of this pandemic so that we can know what's safe to do and what's not safe to do. The president claiming also that we lead in cases because we're doing more testing than anyone else, I think it's fair to call that spin. The important thing to know is what percentage of cases what percentage of those tested are testing positive. And frankly, I don't know what it looks like elsewhere in the world, but I think that that's really the key number to see how deep this pandemic is going into the fabric of our society.
So, Rhonda, there have been suggestions, especially on the state level, that government officials are manipulating or suppressing data to make it look like there's not a rise in cases. How are we able to sort of fact check the data that we're getting both from the federal government and from state governments?
Yeah, that's been really hard because governments are handling this very, very differently from each other. So some states, they have data that go over how much testing they're doing, how many cases they have, how many deaths they've had. They update that weekly. And then, you know, the state next door doesn't collect that much or at least share it with the public. So that's been part of the criticism in a lot of the coronavirus response that we've been seeing across states, that everyone isn't publicly stating their data and informing the public. So, that part is very concerning, that we don't have a general view of what every single state is doing.
That sure is. Democratic leaders in Congress, they've asked President Trump to lower flags to half staff when the coronavirus death toll hits 100,000 in the U.S. And tragically, we have more than 90,000 deaths as of today, so it looks like we're on track to hit that very grim milestone sometime next week. And, you know, there's no denying, Cheryl, this is a human tragedy and painful, but it also matters politically, and we've seen in the past that it matters how someone responds to a tragedy of this magnitude. And I wonder what we can say about the way Democrats are framing this pandemic as opposed to their opponents across the aisle.
Well, I think it's very clear that Democrats are going to frame this pandemic as an abject failure on the part of the administration. I can envision political ads in the fall, ads with clips of President Trump saying this is going to miraculously go away, or that it's not a big deal. It is a big deal. 100,000 Americans dead is a very grim milestone. And I think Democrats in urging flags be lowered to half staff also want to make a point of that. And it clearly is a political point. There's no question that both parties have November on their minds.
And we can hear some noise in the background there, Cheryl, but you did say you're at home
yes,
in Maryland.
I'm sorry about that. I am at home in Maryland, and I'm sorry that the dog has decided to appear, but this is life in COVID-19 times.
Look, this is what we're dealing with at this point. Yes. Jonathan, what about Joe Biden? Is he still, we mentioned before that he was kind of invisible. He was sort of playing it low. Is he still doing that?
He largely is, yes. First, I'll just note that the president did announce last night they will be lowering the flags half-staff. So that's moment where he seems to have agreed with congressional Democrats, although, of course, he didn't say that. Joe Biden has been. It's not the front porch campaign from McKinley and Harding, but rather the basement campaign from his home in Wilmington, Delaware. To this point, he has stepped up his interviews, and in fact, he's getting some blowback this morning for an interview he did with Charlemagne the God, a web interview in which he said some comments that the Trump campaign is seizing upon. What you're seeing there is the risk of what he is doing. He, of course, can't travel. He can't hold rallies. He can't hold in-person events. To this point, that's worked. His campaign, his advisors have decided that keeping him off the grid a little bit is to their benefit, to make the story about the president and the administration's handling of this pandemic. And we have seen the president's poll numbers fall, at least in some battleground states over the last month or two, although, of course, largely. And Joe Biden has opened up larger leads in the national polls. But, of course, those don't really matter heading into November. But the Trump campaign is trying to draw this contrast. We're seeing the president be on the road more. He's been to a number of battleground states in recent weeks, trying to suggest that he is out there trying to push America back to work, try to reopen. And they're trying to paint Biden as someone who is sort of out of touch and their words, afraid to come out. And I think at a certain point, the strategy has worked for Joe Biden, but the Americans will need to hear more from him. That means more interviews. And when safe, when his campaign decides it, to venture out into some sort of controlled events, small settings. A big question, of course, that's on everyone's minds right now is what's going to happen with the conventions this summer.
Yeah.
The Republicans seem really dead set on having at least some sort of gathering in Charlotte in August. The Democrats have already pushed theirs from July to August. It's less clear whether there'll be an actual event in Milwaukee or whether it will all be sort of done online.
Well, Vice President Mike Pence visited Orlando, Florida this week. And during that visit, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, made an interesting comment. He complained that in his view, the media is downplaying the success of his coronavirus response.
I was the number one landing spot from tens of thousands of people leaving the number one hot zone in the world to come to my state. So we've succeeded, and I think that people just don't want to recognize it because it challenges their narrative, it challenges their assumption, so they got to try to find a boogeyman. Maybe it's that there are black helicopters circling the Department of Health. If you believe that, I got a bridge in Brooklyn I'd like to sell you.
Last question.
So, Rhonda, he's referring to some conspiracy theories there, but how much do we know about Florida's response and how well numbers have come down and whether or not DeSantis is right?
Right. Well, you know, one thing that I thought to just start off that I thought was interesting is he sounds very Trump-like. And we know that Ron DeSantis and the president have been close. The president, during the midterm elections, sort of put DeSantis over the edge in a very close gubernatorial race in Florida. And he won, as we've seen. Florida is one of those states that had a lot of criticism early on because they had beaches open, they had spring breakers coming there, and they were criticized as being a little late to close things down and to take things seriously. So I think this is a part of his narrative saying that you all said that we weren't doing things right, but our cases are coming down. I'm not entirely sure if everything he said right there is accurate in terms of how many cases that they have, and if things have improved enough for him to be that confident in what he was saying. But I just was so stunned with the visuals of seeing Vice President Pence standing next to him while the governor is going on this sort of venting session about how bad the media is. It seemed very much like what we see at a White House briefing.
I'm Celeste Headley. You're listening to 1A. The other thing, Cheryl, coming out of Florida is that there's a little bit of I guess, a minor scandal there at the moment. DeSantis criticized a former state health official during that press briefing. Rebecca Jones said she was fired because she refused to alter coronavirus data to fit the state's reopening plan. Did DeSantis say anything about that claim?
Well, you're reading my mind about Rebecca Jones. She was fired on the 5th of May. I believe the governor has dismissed her as someone who is not a real scientist. He said, well, she just has a degree in journalism and geography. But nonetheless, she did say that she single-handedly created the state's online virus dashboard as a way for the people of Florida and researchers to see what the situation was in real time. So that obviously casts doubt on what the governor is saying about his numbers. And Democrats are now accusing him of manipulating the data. We saw the Florida Democrats in the Florida House delegation this week, among them Ted Deutch and Lois Frankel, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and others, say that, you know, the governor was not playing straight with the numbers.
So, Jonathan, we got this note from Dan on Facebook, and I wondered if you'd respond to it, because Dan says, why is anyone trying to make sense of what the president says about anything having to do with COVID-19? He's proven himself to be utterly incompetent in his response and is so clearly trying to make light of anything that even smells of bad news. You can't spin 100,000 deaths as a positive. Stop allowing him to try. So, Jonathan, that seems to be a complaint we've heard before, that perhaps we should not be covering the president's comments on COVID-19 or the response. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think it's difficult to suggest that what a president says isn't newsworthy and therefore shouldn't be covered. I think it needs to be covered rigorously. It needs to be done smartly. It needs to be done with an appropriate amount of fact-checking. And certainly at the Associated Press and the MSNBC and all the outlets that that we're all part of, that's what we try to do. It is difficult. This is sometimes the administration and its allies outside of the White House embark in real disinformation campaigns. It's similar to the smoke machines, the fog that they kicked up during the Russia investigation and during the Ukraine impeachment inquiry. And I wrote about this week that it's a similar, they're trying to do a similar playbook where they create distractions, they make allegations about the opponent, whether it was Hillary Clinton in 2016 or Joe Biden now. They point blame at state governors, particularly Democrats. They point fingers at the Democrats on Capitol Hill. The president disputes science and goes after research studies that don't agree with him. I mean, yes, he often deals in mistruths, misinformation, and sometimes outright lies. But we have to cover them for what they are, call them for what they are. But we certainly can't ignore what he says. He is still the president of the United States.
And Rhonda, in the minute we have left here, I wonder, these trips that both the Vice President Pence and Trump are taking, they seem to be in a lot of swing states. Pence is in Iowa today. Trump was in Michigan, as we mentioned, and Pence was also in Florida. Do we think that the choice of venues is connected to the election and the campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. I think they are probably connected. You mentioned Michigan. The president was there yesterday. That is certainly going to be a battleground state. He's been at odds with the governor and also the attorney general there. So, you know, his campaign may have thought that was the place to be to make sure that the supporters he has there are energized and that they see him going to, you know, the Ford plant and addressing concerns. So I do think that there is sort of a combination of coronavirus response and campaigning on the Trump team.
We have lots more to come and lots more to talk about, including coronavirus numbers. But I wanted to read this email from Susan in Maryland, who says, I'm very concerned about actions being taken to restrict voting and undermine vote by mail, especially with recent actions taken toward aid to the U.S. Postal Service. Please comment. Well, we are going to comment on that, Susan. And if you have questions, if you have things you want to hear about or tell us, you know how to reach us. You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email us. It's 1A@WAMU.org. Still to come, we'll get an update from 1A Across America partner Michigan Radio about the two dams that failed there and the 10,000 people who had to relocate because of that. More from our guests and from you in just a moment. You can play a happy tune on me. A lot of news coming out of Michigan this week, from a devastating flood to a presidential visit. To get the latest on what's happening in the Great Lakes State, let's go now to our 1A Across America partner, Michigan Radio. Zoe Clark is co-host of Michigan Radio's weekly broadcast, It's Just Politics, and she's also becoming a regular guest on 1A lately. Zoe, make yourself at home.
Oh, thanks, Celeste. I know Michigan really needs to give another state a turn to take on some of this news.
Well, in this case, the reason you're here is not necessarily great. 10,000 people are displaced because of two dams that failed. How are they handling evacuations of this size along with social distancing?
I mean, you can imagine the challenges, right? So something like this happens, whether it is a flood, whether it is a hurricane, tornadoes, and the first thing you need to do is find shelter, right? And so maybe you go to a family member's house or a neighbor's, but you can't do that with social distancing. So shelters are being set up in the high school in Midland, in the gymnasium. You can see photos where cots are 6 feet apart. Folks are wearing masks. But you can imagine it is just an added level of logistical challenges that are just sort of unbelievable in this already time of crisis.
And this could become a legal question. The governor, Gretchen Whitmer, says critical infrastructure like a dam should not be privately owned. Famously, there's also a international border, the bridge between Michigan and Canada, that's privately owned. Has she said anything else about the questions that make up how she may handle this question of privately owned critical infrastructure?
Right. Well, this Governor Whitmer has often talked about infrastructure. You might have heard her rallying cry during her 2018 election, which was fix the damn roads. Yes, although we need to note this isn't just a Midland problem or a Michigan problem, right? Dams and bridges and roads. We know the United States lacks in this kind of infrastructure. You know, 100-year-old dams were not built for these new weather patterns. But there doesn't, at least as of right now, appear, or at least before this horrific flooding, that there is the political will nor the money to rebuild for this kind of new world in which we live.
So also, a very vocal group in Michigan has been criticizing the governor for her strict stay-at-home orders. President Trump seemed to have supported their effort. He tweeted out, "Liberate Michigan," last month. But a court on Thursday, just yesterday, handed Whitmer a legal victory on this issue. What does this mean for the governor going forward?
Right. So the Republican-controlled Michigan legislature had filed suit earlier against the governor, basically saying her emergency orders having to do with this pandemic were overreaching against Michigan law, and that indeed they needed what they wanted to be basically legislative approval. But as you say, a judge ruled yesterday that no, under a specific certain Michigan law, that is what this governor now says she's using, that this is within her authority. But Republicans, right after the decision came out yesterday, have already said that they plan to appeal.
And just to add another wrinkle to the busy news day for you, President Trump called out the Secretary of State this week because the Secretary of State mailed out absentee ballot applications to voters. I want to be clear, they were not ballots, they were applications. The president says this is illegal. Is the Secretary of State breaking laws by mailing out applications?
No. We should note that Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, she is a Secretary of State who literally wrote a book about being Secretary of State before she took over the office, so she knows her stuff. We should also mention, fun fact, she's also a former NPR intern. But no, this is not illegal. In 2018, the state of Michigan voted to allow no reason absentee voting in Michigan. As you note, the president tweeted initially and got it wrong in his tweet that she had mailed out ballots. That is just inaccurate. She mailed out the application for the ballots. And it should be noted, too, that this is something that Jocelyn Benson says Republicans in other states have done as well.
Okay, so thank you so much. Zoe Clark is co-host of Michigan Radio's weekly broadcast called It's Just Politics. She comes to us as part of our Across America partnership. Zoe, thank you.
Thanks, Celeste.
So I want to get back to these questions that our listeners have sent about this particular issue. She's mentioned the Attorney General in Michigan, Dana Nessel, not happy about how things went during Trump's visit there.
You said right here on CNN that if President Trump doesn't wear a mask, he'll be asked not to return to any undisclosed facilities in your state. Is the president no longer welcome in Michigan?
Well, I will say, speaking on behalf of my department and my office, that's right. That's exactly right. I mean, today's events were extremely disappointing and yet totally predictable.
So there you heard Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel in an interview with CNN's Wolf Blitzer on Thursday. That was after Trump's visit to Michigan. Jonathan, what is the conflict here between Trump and a number of Michigan officials, particularly, as we mentioned, the governor and attorney general?
He is feuding right now with most of the state government, it seems like. Yeah, it's a few things. He and Governor Whitmer, of course, a Democrat, clashed some weeks ago. The governor believed that the federal response to the pandemic was slow, that it wasn't supplying needed life-saving medical devices like ventilators and such. The president responded in kind by criticizing her, saluting those protesters who gathered in Lansing, urging the state to be reopened. A lot of those in the crowd there appear to be Trump supporters and wearing Make America Great Again apparel. So that has been simmering for a time, although it should be noted the president says he and the governor did speak this week about the flooding and that it was a productive phone call. And now we have the issue with the attorney general over masks. The president, of course, has not worn a mask in public on any of his, whether it be at the White House or in his previous trips to places like Arizona and Pennsylvania. He has told advisors, we've written this, that he doesn't like the symbol it sends, that he feels like it makes him too concerned about the health crisis, his own health, and not about the economy, which is what he wants to focus on. He's also told people close to him he thinks he would look ridiculous in a mask and is afraid of it ending up in a Democrat campaign ad. Yesterday in Michigan, he did tell reporters, and a photograph emerged of him briefly wearing a mask in a portion of his tour of this Ford facility, but it was not the part that was open to the public. And in fact, at one point, he even showed reporters a mask he'd been carrying on in his pocket and sort of taunted them, saying, like, I didn't want you to get a look at me in this.
And handed a face shield to the audio guy, weirdly.
Exactly. And now, if the attorney general is to be believed, he won't be welcome back.
So, Rhonda, we mentioned that many of these stops could be connected to the campaign, and yet we get this email from Barron in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who says it didn't go unnoticed yesterday that POTUS did visit the Ford plant as it provided a platform for him to rally politically, yet he couldn't go 90 minutes north to visit the Midland dam breaking tragedy. So this calls up the question of whether these stops are doing what he wants them to do. But Rhonda, I have this question from Reed in Tallahassee, Florida, who says, I keep hearing about Trump's threat to withhold funding from states. Which funds are at play and under what authority could he accomplish this? This is not just, he hasn't threatened to just withhold funding to Michigan, but Nevada as well over mail-in voting.
Right. So if the threat was to hold any sort of coronavirus aid, a lot of that, what Congress has passed, that's already been dispersed to a lot of states. So they're really, I'm not sure if there's any teeth to the threat of holding any aid from them. And you also have to look at the legal issue, too. For the president to withhold aid, that would involve Congress. That was actually the whole impeachment proceedings. It was based on the idea that the president did not seek Congress's approval to withhold aid from Ukraine. So in terms of presidential power to withhold aid over the what he thinks is a fraudulent election, you know, I do not believe that there is any legal backing for him to do that. So the tweet that he said, as we've just talked about, that was more of a threat and sort of sowing seeds of potential voter fraud in Michigan rather than being actually accurate that he can withhold aid.
However, the president is not the only one posing a threat, perhaps, to the November elections. The director of the CDC, Robert Redfield, warns there will likely be another flare-up of coronavirus in the U.S. this fall and winter, and that could lead to another round of stay-at-home orders and business shutdowns. And Cheryl, we've heard this warning before. Why are we hearing again from public health officials about these concerns over an outbreak in the fall?
Because it's true, there may be an outbreak in the fall. What Dr. Redfield said is that we've seen evidence that the pandemic would go south in the southern hemisphere, and similar to the way flu does. And he says that appears to be happening in places like Brazil. And then he said when the southern hemisphere is over, he suspects it will reground itself in the north. Separate from that, we know that the reopening of the economies is likely to result in a spike in cases. So we've heard very clear warnings, not only from Dr. Redfield, but also from Tony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert, that if we reopen too quickly, it could backfire. It could cause a surge in cases. And Fauci has interestingly made the argument that that surge in cases could also hurt the economy. It could have a backlash not only on health, but on the economy. And separate from that, we know that the fall is the flu season. So what we could have is coronavirus coupled with a difficult flu season. Last year alone, or rather in 2018, almost 80,000 people died from flu. So that's going to put a lot of stress on the system.
I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to 1A. Also this week, hundreds of doctors signed a letter to President Trump Tuesday. They urged him to end the, quote, national shutdown, end quote. Let's be very clear here. It is the states and not the president who have control over stay-at-home orders and closing businesses and schools. But in this letter, they compared the lockdown to a mass casualty incident with exponentially growing health consequences. So, Jonathan, what do we know about these doctors and the goal of this letter?
We are seeing that a number of doctors have been recruited by the president, allies, and Republicans to put forth this sort of message. My colleagues at the AP had a terrific scoop this week. They were able to get a recording of a conference call in which members of the Trump campaign, those associated with the Trump campaign, are looking to recruit doctors, some with perhaps more questionable credentials than others, to carry out this message, the idea of what the president has been saying, that of course, yes, there are health consequences to reopen the government and the country, but there also would be those if there weren't. The president likes to point out that he does not cite any evidence or hard statistics of the idea of the people who can't go to work face issues like substance abuse and, you know, unemployment and potentially even suicide or death. So the group here is carrying out this message, and we are already seeing them populate in sort of conservative-friendly parts of the media. A number of them were on Fox News yesterday. And I think that it is going to be a conflicting message for Americans who listen to doctors, all of whom seem to have the same titles, say very different things about what's safe to go forward.
All right. In a different story, officials in Franklin County, Ohio, the state's most populous county, they've declared racism a public health crisis. That was a resolution that passed Tuesday. It was passed in response to the racial health disparities highlighted by this pandemic and the disproportionate number of Black residents who've been hospitalized because of the virus. Rhonda, what does this mean? What happens when racism is declared a public health crisis?
Yeah, well, the Franklin County commissioners there, they in that resolution noted that Public health officials say that when large numbers of people are affected and their health is threatened in two long-term issues, that requires adoption of large-scale solutions. And this was a part of them trying to adopt an idea that shows that there is a systemic racism that has been at play in the disparities we are now seeing with coronavirus. So they wanted to acknowledge that as an official body in Franklin County there in Ohio. I think one of the really interesting things to me, and I am an Ohioan, actually, I'm from Ohio, Franklin County is not a majority Black or a majority minority county. It is majority white, and the county commissioners there, two are white, one is Black. It's really interesting that they decided to step forward and do this resolution. I also think what's interesting, too, is this week, public health officials in Franklin County also had to apologize for some guidance that they put out to African Americans about mask wearing. They had suggested in the guidance that African Americans and minorities should not wear masks that have any gang symbolism on them, or shouldn't wear bandanas in case people think you are a part of unsavory activities. That was written down guidance. So yeah. Franklin County had to apologize for that too. So it seems like, you know, the county commissioners took a step forward, acknowledging that racism is a public health crisis,
yeah.
And then, you know, a few steps back with this apology that they had to put out for this mask guidance.
All right, we've been talking to Rhonda Colvin, congressional reporter at The Washington Post. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. And Jonathan Lemire is White House reporter with The Associated Press, also a political analyst with MSNBC. Thanks to all three of you. Remember, we do have a text club. We only send you one text a day, promise. It's the fastest way to connect with us. And details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. Before we go, we continue with our tradition with stories about acts of kindness. Today's story comes from Donna in Lockport, New York.
When my husband got COVID-19 in early April, our friends, about 8 to 10 people, came over one afternoon and made huge chalk drawings and messages on our driveway and sidewalks. They covered the entire surfaces. And for us to see them out there doing this was so uplifting. We had been feeling so isolated because we'd been in quarantine for probably 7 or 8 days at that time. The messages lasted quite a while until it rained, and it continued to give us so much enjoyment.
That is such a great story. Thank you so much, Donna. If you have an act of kindness to share, we want to hear from you. Our number is 855-236-1212. 1A's socially distant lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. I'm waving to him on Zoom right now. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.